Authors Over 50, Writing in Life's Sweetest Third. Authors Over 50's weekly podcast celebrates writers and their journeys to publication. Writing after 50 is a whole story on its own, so let's skip to Life's Sweetest Third and talk with authors about their journey from pen to publish. Welcome, I'm Julia Daly, your host, and I invite you to listen to interviews with writers who've achieved their goal of publishing a book just later in life. We've seen award lists for under 30 or under 40, but I've yet to see lists for those who've achieved a significant milestone of their own, launching a new career and publishing their first book after the age of 50. We will hear about these authors' inspirations, struggles, strategies, and the smell of that first book. These writers' journeys inspire me because I'm one of them. Inspired by the many teachers who mentored her, my guest today became an educator and enjoyed a multi-decade career working with middle school children as well as with prospective teachers. Retired now, she is Professor Emerita at Georgia State University, Atlanta, Georgia, and holds degrees from the William Patterson University, Purdue University, and Indiana University. She received the Alumni Distinguished Professor Award, the Outstanding Social Studies Educator in Georgia Award, and the Refugee Champion Award. Her academic research and writing focused on effective teaching and leadership strategies in cultural diverse settings. But her latest writing is a debut book for the general public, Seeing Eye Girl, a memoir of madness, resilience, and hope, will launch on July 5th, 2022. Welcome to Authors Over 50, Beverly J. Armento.
Thank you so much, Julia. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're excited to have you. Beverly, our opening question is always the same on Authors Over 50. What took you so long to write a book?
It's a great question. And, as you just suggested, I had a very long and really totally fulfilling, quite rewarding career as an educator, both in middle schools, elementary schools, and at the college level. And, I was really fully engrossed in my career. So that's the primary reason. But, and then even after I retired, I kept teaching. But the second real reason is that I just wasn't ready, even after all these years, I just wasn't ready to write about my life until in retirement, I took a creative nonfiction writing class, and something happened in that class. A couple sessions in, the teacher said, write about hair. And so I just started writing, and this is part of what came out of me. The first beating started when I was 7. Mama's voice was shrill. She snatches me by my arm, yanks me off my crate, flings me onto the floor, and kicks me in my side. I curl into a ball and cry. Whoosh! A flood escapes from between my legs. I piddle all over the floor. She kicks me again and grabs my hair as she pulls me through the wet mess, wiping the floor with me, a mop. Well, when it came time to read this to the class, I just couldn't. My voice broke. And at that instant, I thought, it's time to write that memoir. So that was kind of the formal opening. That poem then became a chapter. It's now about chapter 5. And that was the beginning of the memoir. I decided then and there, you know, I'd waited long enough. I put it off, and now I was ready, emotionally ready to get this out of me.
Well, that's quite a chilling chapter, Beverly, and I'm so sorry for the horrendous childhood that you experienced, but to put it into a memoir form and to get it out of your body, I've heard other memoirists say that it's very, it's like going through therapy, you know, to get it all on the page and to try to see it through adult eyes instead of children's eyes.
You know, there's been a long time. You know, this is the story of my life up until I was 24, and then there's an epilogue that picks up almost 20 years after that. So there are many years that have passed. And in that time, I've done a lot of work trying to understand my life and my mother and myself. And so it wasn't as traumatic as if I would have written it soon after I did leave home. But I think at that time, I wasn't ready to write the book that I write, that I've written now. Now, I believe I have the perspective that I need to write the book. And I was convinced that I did not want to write, it's not a Mama Dearest book. I'm not angry with my mother. I really try to show understanding and compassion toward my mother. And secondly, I didn't want people to feel sorry for me. I wanted people to see the resilience that I had and the strength that I had. Even though, you know, in the book, I call myself, you know, strong Beverly and weak Beverly. There was definitely a weak side of me. But I write this, I mean, this is one woman's story, but in my maturity, I've come to understand this is the story of many people. You know, psychologists call in my experience, like an adverse childhood experience, you know, and mine was physical and emotional abuse. But there's so many different kinds of adverse experiences that young people have in the home or in the community. And now with the pandemic, just think about the additional adverse childhood experiences that children have had, the isolation, the being away from their schools, their friends, their teachers, their sports. Almost 200,000 children in the United States alone have lost a parent or a caregiver during the pandemic. I mean, we're experiencing a new kind of adverse childhood experience. So, you know, I write this book to prompt discussion about those young people or those adults who, like me, you know, swallowed it all and presented themselves as nothing wrong with me, you know, cheerful, everything is good, and that's your face to the world. So, and I write it for the teachers and the mentors who give these young people strength, whether they know it or not. You know, my teachers may or may not have known anything about what was going on in my home, but they nurtured me. They were kind to me. They encouraged me. They made me think that I could do anything. You know, now that's what every teacher should do with every child. You know, whether you think the child is in trouble or not. And, you know, we know that that doesn't happen in every classroom, but teachers, I tried to send that message to them that every child is important and every child has potential. And your job is to nurture that potential. Love every child. As my colleague Asa Hilliard used to say, just imagine that every child is your child and every child is a genius. So if teachers and coaches and people who work in any setting with young people believe that, then a lot more children who are in pain would feel empowered.
I can just sense what a wonderful, compassionate advocate you were for those children in under your care. And I applaud teachers. My mother was a teacher. I was a teacher. My daughter is a teacher. And we thought about each one of those little children who came into our classroom every single day, even when I was at the university level. I thought about every child who walked in that door and what they had to endure before they came into that classroom. And I wanted to make sure that that classroom was a safe place and a happy place and one where they were accepted and loved and cared for.
I love that. We're singing the same tune,
yes,
Julia.
Yes, we are.
It's so important. It's so important. And it's not like, you know, we're not asking teachers to do extra duty. Just be kind, be human, be real, believe in the child. You know, I was a dirty kid from the projects. You know, my teachers looked past that, you know, and we've got to look past some things, or we've got to help kids get some clean clothes or whatever's necessary. But in any case, the school and whatever religious institution or sporting outlets children have access to, all of those adults are really important in children's lives. And it's just real important that that message be sent to people. I know teachers are frustrated. They're exhausted. Nurses are exhausted. It's been an awful time for teachers to survive, you know, and we've lost people during the pandemic. You know, teaching can be a wonderful career, and it's a very important time in children's lives. It's important for them to have great teachers.
It's very vital, and I can just see you as an example to them. You know, if I could do this, you can do this. And where you came from and what you've achieved has been miraculous, really. Tell us what Seeing Eye Girl, the title, means.
Well, my mother was blind. My mother was blind. And she was diagnosed as an infant. And the doctor said, your child will, you know, eventually go blind. And there's nothing we can do. You know, back in those days, there was nothing that that could be done. And so by the time, so her vision deteriorated. There's a lot of artistic talent on my mother's side of the family. And my mother was very artistic herself. And while she still had sight, she drew and drew and drew and drew. And at school, the teachers had her using colored chalk, like copied Norman Rockwell Christmas scenes on the chalkboard during the holidays. So everyone knew this is a great artist, but her eyes continued to get worse. So at 18, she was living in Western New York. This was in the late 30s, early 40s. And there was a CCC camp, Civilian Conservation Corps camp, at a large state park near my mother's home, Letchworth State Park. And my Italian father, along with many, many other urban kids who, you know, were coming out of the Depression, and pretty soon there's going to be World War II, you know, so there were many unemployed. And so the Letchworth State Park CCC camp had Friday night dances. And they used to send buses into all these little towns surrounding Letchworth State Park to pick up girls to come to the dances. So my mother and her girlfriends, you know, she was 18 years old, got on the bus, much against her mother's wishes, and they went to the dances. So my mother met Tony Armento, and they fell in love, and sort of the rest is history. So at 19, she's totally blind, and she has me, her first child. I mean, you know, they were married, they ran away. My mother essentially ran away from home because she knew her mother, A, was not happy that she had an Italian boyfriend and was not happy that she was even thinking about getting married, a blind girl at 18. You know, it was against her mother's wishes. So they secretly got married. They went to Yonkers, New York, which was his hometown where I was born and where the beginning of the story takes place. So the part of the book that I'd like to read is when my mother regains her sight. She met a wonderful doctor we were living in Miami, named Bascom Palmer. Bascom Palmer later becomes quite famous, and you may have heard of the Bascom Palmer Eye Center in Miami at, I think it's called the Miller Hospital. I'll check that in just a moment. In the early days, in 1950, when she had the two of the earliest successful corneal transplants in the country. These surgeries were not being done then. You know, now it's done as outpatient surgery. You're in and out, 3 hours max. My mother was in the hospital for 2 weeks and had sandbags around her head, so she did not move. They were afraid that the stitches would break. So that's where, so she regains her sight. It's quite a story. And she becomes kind of famous because she's had these miracle surgeries. She's got four kids by now. She's raised these four kids. She made many of our clothes, you know, like amazing. You know, she kept house. The only trouble is that when I was about five, there was a traumatic event at the house. And it's nobody knows for sure, but my mother, my early memories of my mother, she was quite normal, quite loving. I had a wonderful early 5 years, my foundation years, because I had a loving father and a loving mother. I think, though, this traumatic event, she had a psychological break during that event. And from thenceforth and evermore, she was delusional. She was violent. She was frantic. And, you know, in those days, it wasn't easy to get help. And she refused help. So that's where the madness comes in the title. So the home, you know, for my sister and me, she did not touch my brothers or my half brothers with a Polish stepfather. So we looked different. You know, the girls were dark and Italian, looked like the father. The boys were light and blonde and looked like the father. Anyway, my mother was pretty angry with my father, needless to say, and thus she was pretty angry with us girls. And so the childhood turns out to be a little traumatic.
Well, tell us about your publishing journey. Did you have challenges, publicity that worked or didn't? Tell us a little bit about how you published this book.
My publishing journey, you know, for a while I thought I'd go after a traditional publisher. And I'm very active in the Atlanta Writers Club. Twice a year, they have wonderful conferences, bring in agents and editors. And I submitted my first 50 pages. And I was really rewarded time and time again with awards, you know, best manuscript, best pitch. So I was encouraged. And I did that for a while. And I thought, you know, Beverly, these people sort of forget about you when they go back to the office. And so we need to start thinking. And then during my retirement, I had taken a wonderful class called Write Your Memoir in 6 Months with Brooke Warner and Linda Joy Myers. And I started to think, you know, I think they have a publishing arm also. Let me investigate that. And of course, she writes. And I did my research. And I thought, you know, this is a reputable, great, independent publisher. Why don't I submit to them? And I did. And the rest of that is history. It's been a wonderful journey. I've had nothing but great support, outstanding editors, outstanding project manager, outstanding publisher, outstanding artist who created what I think is a wonderful cover. It's been a great experience. And soon it'll be, you know, ready for folks to read. So I do have I have a publicity company working with me. I have a publicist, and they're trying to, you know, these months before the book launches on July 5th, these early months are the ones when you try to arouse some interest, try to spread the word that Seeing Eye Girl is on the way. And So my publicist is working hard, and I'm working hard at the local end, trying to identify book clubs and others, independent bookstores where I might do a reading, a book signing.
It's a very exciting time. Why don't you read a few paragraphs for us so that we can hear your tone and voice in the book?
Okay. So this is the Mama Can See chapter. And it starts with a little poem that I wrote as a nine-year-old in the days following my mother's coming home. It's called My Mother. My mother, my mother, my mother is she, with two beautiful eyes that could not see. One day from school I came, I heard someone call my name. With bandages off, my mother could see. A thrill I'll remember until eternity. February 17th, 1950. Beverly, Mama's voice comes through the screen door. She's been in Jackson Memorial Hospital for the last 13 days. I've waited for this day, imagined how she'll change, how our lives will be different now that she can see. I wonder if she'll love me like she used to. She can see me. My heart thumps in my throat. Tears flow down my cheeks. I have so many mixed feelings about my mother and this day. I'm excited and happy that Mama's corneal transplant has been successful. And I'm optimistic that this miracle will bring back the mother I love, the one in my Yonkers dreams. But I'm also apprehensive and afraid she'll always be angry with me. Perhaps even more now that she can see how much I look like Dad. I can only hope for the best. I pull the screen door open. Mama, Mama. She gets up from her chair. We stand there in the living room, frozen for a moment, staring at each other. Then I run into her open arms and sob. I'm so relieved. My Yonkers mama is back. She holds me for the longest time, our bodies pressed tightly together, my face lost in her bosom. Her heart throbs in my ear. Oh, Mama, I'm so happy, I say. Mama's distracted by the blaring radio that's on the table near her chair. She turns and snaps it off, but not before I hear the broadcaster talking about the big speech that Senator Joseph McCarthy gave just a few days ago in West Virginia. That's when he said folks working at the State Department were communists. Mama is an expert on the communists. And she likes to keep up with all the news. Stand over here and let me see how pretty you are, she says. She sits down in her favorite upholstered chair and pulls me close. She puts her hands on my face, touches my hair, my wet cheeks, my nose, my mouth. Her fingertips trace my square chin. She's done this before, only this time she can see. She can see the brown of my hair, the flush on my cheeks, my almond skin. She can see the four bands of lace down the front of my sleeveless white blouse. And she can see the white flowers on the black, loosely gathered skirt, a skirt she made for me. I realize that in all of my 9 years and 17 days of life, this is the first time that Mama has actually seen me. Mama has bathed, nursed, diapered, caressed, and burped me. She has hit, punched, kicked, and bitten me. She has encouraged, nurtured, protected, intimidated, and terrified me. But today, Mama is finally seeing me, her firstborn. She can see my smile, my tears, my face, the face that looks just like Dad's, square chin, deeply set dark eyes, broad nose, high cheekbones.
Well, you really have a story to tell, Beverly. That is such a mix of emotions. You've got us on a roller coaster ride there. You know, our writers over 50 are really a different group. You know, we've all had so many careers before now, and now we've written our first book after the age of 50. Would you give any advice for those who are 50 and above? Maybe something that you wish you'd heard when you started out?
Well, I first must say, you know, after I started out and started reading a lot of memoirs, Sue Williams Silverman, she's written several memoirs, and they all are close to my heart. But she also wrote a book for writers called Fearless Confessions. And I must say to you, writers over 50, just go for it. You know, you have nothing to lose. Be fearless. You know, tell your story or many stories. And don't be afraid to put your words down. The second bit of advice is, you know, it takes a village. Become part of a community of writers. Look in your city. You know, if you live in a moderate to large city, you're going to find writing groups. Here in Atlanta, there are many writing groups. These are places where you can find other writers. You'll find many older writers. Might surprise you, many younger writers. But there are writers, and there's somebody writing in your genre. You know, attach yourself to a critique group. You know, these are the folks who you will come to love. If you're lucky enough, as I was, to be part of a group that sustained itself over many years, the same group of people. We knew each other. We knew each other's lives. We knew each other's writing. But we remembered that we were in the group for a purpose. We had to be thoughtful and critical about the other person's writing and give the person helpful feedback. And you can do that in a gentle way. But you need feedback. You know, you're writing, you might be just writing for your grandchildren. But, most of us write because someday we want to have readers. If you're writing about any sensitive topic, and most topics are sensitive, whether you think so or not, get people in that group to read and give you feedback. You know, don't let your words be a surprise. Or the criticism of your words be a surprise after it's bound and printed. Get feedback early and do it often. Join a community. Those are my two words of advice.
Well, that's excellent advice. And the word I heard from you was fearless, for us to be fearless. And you must have told your little child self that many times, because you have overcome so much and achieved so much. And we are just so happy that you're one of our authors over 50. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today. Please look for Authors Over 50 every Thursday when we will have conversations with accomplished debut novelists over the age of 50. Please subscribe and share with a friend. And check out my own publication journey after 50 at www.juliadaily, that's D-A-I-L-Y, like daily newspaper.com. Until next time, keep reading and writing. And remember, it's never too late to fulfill a dream in life's sweetest third.